Thanks, Ned, and in particular, I'm honored to be delivering a lecture in memory of Jerry Wolpin, who was one of the fiercest intellects I've ever encountered, and one of the nicest people I've ever encountered, which is a rare combination. And thanks, of course, to Ned for that splendid introduction. One of the many benefits of holding public office in this country is that occasionally it gives you a chance to speak at schools that you could not have gotten into as a student. And if you had gotten in, you couldn't have gotten through. So this evening, I'm particularly pleased to find myself invited to St. John's. Please understand that I'm very much in awe of this school and the highest standard it stands for. And I deeply appreciate a chance not only to talk to you, but also to have spoken with several of you earlier before I got to this podium. For that and for allowing me to speak here and to give and for the give and take that's going to follow, I hope, I thank you very much. That said, I'm going to turn to the evening's topic, which regrettably I could not come up with a title, hence you got no title in advance, and so I'm particularly grateful to all of you for showing up tonight on faith without even having had the hook of a title to hang your anticipation on. I thought initially that I would talk about the Islamist terrorism that we've been trying to deal with for several decades and its current manifestations and what the likelihood is that we can overcome it within our lifetime, and by our I mean both yours and mine, a subject that's been a staple of my repertoire for some time. But then came the election, which I guess still would have allowed for a description of where we are in that struggle, but would have cast some doubt on whatever advice I might give, because the new administration is still taking shape and formulating its policies. And despite the many tweets and some of the testimony during the confirmation hearings, we still really don't know all the details of the administration's policies. But also, there arose a political phenomenon that didn't exactly debut, but certainly sharpened during and after the election that I think challenges what actually holds us together as a nation and may represent, if it's allowed to continue, a graver threat than any Islamist doctrine. Some of it had already started on college campuses, but the rest of the world caught on in a hurry. And here I'm talking about the phenomenon of people not being able to put up with a political result that contradicts their expectations and preferences, which is to say, when I say not being able to put up with, I mean really strong psychological reaction or claims of strong psychological reaction that usually involve wallowing with others in a shared misery, and sometimes involving calls to form committees to provide legal assistance for as yet unimagined invasions of people's rights and to provide support for what is certain to be the worsening plight of most of the vulnerable in society, usually expressed in terms of race or sexual orientation, and occasionally both, and everybody getting together and listening for the tanks to rumble. As I said, the phenomenon started on college campuses, and it started sort of as a combination of the goldfish-swallowing craze of the first third of the 20th century and the student radicalism of the mid to late 1960s. However, the outside world, or at least a substantial part of it, is on its way toward becoming one vast college campus, planted thick with rules about what may and may not be said, and even how to say what may be said. And although the world is becoming like the campuses, that doesn't mean that the campuses themselves don't remain in the vanguard of this trend. At Yale, a dispute last year about Halloween costumes, really, led students to surround a college master and his wife, Nicholas and Erica Christakis, both highly accomplished academics, and to scream obscenities at them, after which the Christakises were left so unprotected that they had to resign. And the president of the university, Peter Salovey, announced a $50 million grant to promote diversity and heal racial wounds by, among other things, establishing a center for the study of race, indigeneity, and transnational migration, whatever the hell that means. In what looks like an attempt then to one-up himself, President Salovey followed up this center with the incomprehensible name by setting up a committee to establish principles on renaming, so as to consider, for example, whether to rename Calhoun College, named initially for John C. Calhoun, who some of you may know served as a congressman, a senator, Secretary of War, Vice President, but who was also a supporter of slavery. President Salovey actually had announced that Calhoun College would not be renamed, but he then decided to leave it up to the new committee as to whether to rename Calhoun College. I hope President Salovey is careful to restrict the jurisdiction of that committee because, as a man named Roger Kimball pointed out in a splendid article in the Wall Street Journal several months ago, John C. Calhoun was a piker when compared to Elihu Yale himself, who didn't merely support slavery, but he actually bought and sold human beings. So stay tuned. Any day now, we may wake up to find that Yale University has been renamed, or that it's called, kind of like the artist formerly known as Prince, the university formerly known as Yale. Actually, to make the record complete, I should acknowledge an op-ed column that President Salovey published in the Wall Street Journal after Roger Kimball's article, in which he portrayed Yale as a largely peaceful garden of diverse views, although he had to take a bit of poetic license at some points in his essay to do that. For example, the article tells us that no one is permitted, quote, to disrupt or otherwise prevent a scheduled speaker from having his or her say, unquote. Now, I should pause at this point and tell you that Jerry Wolpin, in whose memory I'm delivering this lecture, had his lecture disrupted and had to be escorted from the hall due to precisely such a disruption. At other points in the article, the sort of bureaucratic fog covers nasty facts and blurs the outlines, kind of like snow falling on garbage. So the disgusting treatment of the Christakises is wrapped in a reference to, quote, difficult confrontations and moments which individuals demonstrated poor judgment about where and how to speak, unquote. And for good measure, because cameras recorded part of what happened, he adds that, quote, in a volatile world with social media and cameras on every phone, emotional moments can be taken out of context and magnified, distorting or obscuring an accurate view of events. Or to put it another way, who are you going to believe, me or your lion eyes? Now, I won't say that similar episodes have occurred at many schools because each one has its own madcap feature, so it's hard to describe them as similar. But almost equally egregious episodes have taken place at Brown, Bowdoin, Vanderbilt, you name it. I seriously doubt, based on the people I met today, that any such episodes have occurred here, and so it's kind of nice to be at a place where that's unlikely to happen. To be sure, there are occasional pockets of resistance. At the University of Chicago, for example, where the Dean of Students, John Ellison, affirmed in a letter to freshmen that the university is committed to free speech, and just so that there could be no mistake about the focus of his concern, he added that, quote, our commitment to academic freedom means that we do not support so-called trigger warnings, we do not cancel invited speakers because their topics might prove controversial, and we do not condone the creation of intellectual safe spaces where individuals can retreat from ideas and perspectives at odds with their own. However, after Dean Ellison issued his letter, it was responded to with another letter from 150 University of Chicago faculty members who said that although they held varied views on safe spaces and trigger warnings, they wanted to assure the incoming freshmen, and indeed to assure everybody at the University of Chicago and the world at large, that all 150 of them thought it entirely legitimate for such measures as safe spaces and trigger warnings to be requested by students, and the availability of such measures debated, and that the debate could encompass whether speech could ultimately be interrupted by what the letter called, quote, concrete pressures of the political, unquote. Now, I guess I could stand here for whatever time is allotted to me and whatever patience you have and regale you with accounts not just from the academy, but also from the workplace and the political arena, wherever we live and work, and we could all have several good hearty laughs at the expense of the blowhards who are inflicting this on us and the weasels who are going along with it. But when we have 150 faculty members at the University of Chicago who sign on to a single letter, which is a signal achievement in itself, 150 faculty members signing on to one letter, a letter in which they tell us we should all consider whether there are instances in which it is legitimate to interrupt speech due to, quote, concrete pressures of the political, unquote. When we've gotten that far, it's not a laughing matter. Now, I assume that all of us here are against that sort of thing, or at least most of us. But we should also be somewhat dismayed to see that, as Nadine Strossen of the ACLU wrote to me recently, people we had hoped to expect to be stalwart defenders of free speech instead are giving in to the current vogue of silencing opinions they may find disturbing or with which they may disagree in order to reach outcomes or conclusions they find socially worthy. I think we owe it to the seriousness of the subject and to the seriousness of this audience to press beyond a description of symptoms and to ask how and why we got here. Here being the point where you can get 150 faculty members at the University of Chicago to agree that we have to consider whether speech may have to yield on occasion to, their phrase, concrete pressures of the political. Let's start by unpacking that phrase, concrete pressures of the political. How can the political, which whatever it is an abstraction, an idea or a series of ideas, how can an abstraction impose concrete pressures? If the term concrete pressure has any meaning, it's tangible pressure, palpable pressure, urgent pressure, the kind of pressure you feel if somebody holds a gun to your head or is holding somebody you love and know hostage against the demand that you change your conduct. That's concrete pressure. But how does the political exercise concrete pressure? I think the answer to that is that the pressure is concrete if you take the position that there is only one acceptable answer to a political question. The politically correct answer. Once you get that far, anything else is unacceptable, concretely unacceptable. Unacceptable to the point where the legitimacy of the outcome of what appeared to be a rough but free and fair election is called into question as having come about due to the intervention of Vladimir Putin or James Comey or some combination or perhaps conspiracy between them. So how did we get to a politics that exerts concrete pressure? Part of the answer, I think, lies in not being aware of what it is that really holds us together as a nation and as a civilization. The emphasis we place, often with great pride, on the claim that we are a nation of laws, usually in contrast to a nation of men, or perhaps a nation of people, I should say, in order to be politically correct. The idea being that we are governed by objective rules rather than by the will or whim of a ruler, which is certainly a good thing. But that's not the only will or whim that's bearing down on us. Nor is it the most dangerous one, as I think I can show. In fact, it's possible easily to put more emphasis on this being a nation of laws than is good for anyone. I think most of you go about your daily business and contribute to the general welfare without worrying too much about the law. And that's a good thing, particularly if you stop and consider the places where people have to go about their daily business while keeping their minds constantly on what the law is and what it requires of them, and what it can do to them if those requirements are not met. You'll realize that countries where people go about like that, with constant focus on the law, are most typically countries like North Korea or Cuba or Russia, where whether or not you have the law constantly in focus, the law has you constantly in focus. I think it isn't really being a nation of laws that actually holds us together. Rather, I think what holds us together is what Lord Fletcher Moulton referred to in an essay that he wrote back in 1924, as obedience to the unenforceable. The unenforceable being one of three domains that exist around us, another being the laws, which I already mentioned, and the remaining one being personal whim, which is the other kind of whim that I hinted at before, other than the whim of a ruler, and that's the kind of whim that bears down on us today. In his 1924 essay, Lord Moulton put it this way. He said, quote, "The real greatness of a nation, its true civilization, is measured by the extent of this land of obedience to the unenforceable. It measures the extent to which the nation trusts its citizens and its area, that is the area of the land of obedience to the unenforceable, testifies to the way they behave in response to that trust," unquote. With the expansion and proliferation today of laws, technical rules on the one hand, and the increasing space occupied by the domain of whim, the degree to which personal choice and taste is the defining basis for what we allow ourselves and others to do, the space occupied by what Lord Moulton said defined the greatness of a nation, the space occupied by obedience to the unenforceable, is getting smaller by the day in this country, if not actually by the hour. Now, I'm not the first person to talk about this tendency, I'm sure. Obviously, Lord Moulton did it in his essay in 1924, and many others have since. probably including commencement speakers. It's the kind of thing that's natural for a commencement speech. But why should this be of particular concern to an audience of people for whom the law is at least a subject of academic interest, if not yet a source of livelihood? One reason is that personal taste and preference have started to impinge not only on people, how people behave with respect to themselves and toward one another, both in public and in private, but also on how they view reality, the degree to which they are willing to accept the idea of objective truth, particularly to the extent that it may conflict with a belief that they consider important. And objective truth is something people have to accept if, among other things, our legal system is to function as it should. It's something I submit they should also have to accept if we're going to make important political decisions in a sensible way. Now, in the real world, things happen one way and one way only. Of course, we've heard of conspiracy theories about all manner of public events. In our own lifetimes, everything from the assassination of President Kennedy to the collapse of the housing bubble and the credit markets in 2008 is the subject of theories, some of them pretty crazy. But again, either Lee Harvey Oswald shot President Kennedy or he didn't, and either he acted alone or he didn't, and those are provable facts. And either the housing bubble built up due to a chain of objectively provable events, or it didn't. In my own line of work, or former line of work in criminal cases, juries are instructed that they must decide whether the government has presented evidence sufficient to convince them, beyond a reasonable doubt, that a certain set of facts exists. Facts including a defendant's state of mind, to be sure, but facts nonetheless. Underlying that instruction, which is given in courthouses all over this country every day, is the assumption, an assumption that's unstated, but nonetheless real, that, as I said, things happen one way, and one way only. Either the defendant did or didn't pull the trigger, and if he did, he either did or didn't have the necessary intent to commit a crime. As I said, that kind of instruction is given every day in courthouses all over this country, and for all I know, still governs in most of them. But in a totally different setting, we've heard it said that our government, principally our intelligence agencies, have engaged in questionable conduct in their gathering of intelligence. It's been said that they violated national and international laws against torture, or that they engaged in unlawful surveillance of U.S. citizens, listening in on their telephone conversations, reading their emails, creating electronic profiles of them by monitoring who they call and who calls them. Now, either those things have happened or they haven't. Either the trigger was pulled with criminal intent or it wasn't. Either government agents have acted unlawfully or they haven't. Or so I have always thought until now. But there's an alternative approach that has increasingly caught hold and that I think threatens to overwhelm even how legal disputes get decided and certainly how political disputes get decided. That approach makes facts secondary to narratives. We saw this recently in such diverse places as Ferguson, Missouri, and the halls of Congress. We've all read about what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, where a white police officer shot a black teenager who was unarmed but was apparently going for the officer's gun. But I'll wager that far less ink has been spilled over what actually happened there than over how people reacted to it, what they thought, and what their narrative was. In Congress, we've heard U.S. senators who either know better, or at the very least should know better, claim that the NSA is listening in on telephone conversations, or that the CIA has conducted interrogations using torture, apparently because that's a narrative that some substantial number of their constituents are willing to buy into. As to interrogation techniques, one newspaper, the New York Times, or the newspaper of record, as it likes to call itself, or TNOR, as several friends and I call it with more than a trace of sarcasm, TNOR has decided that as a matter of editorial style, it will refer to interrogation techniques used by the CIA as torture, notwithstanding that torture is defined in a federal statute that sets forth certain required elements of proof, and there is good reason to doubt that any of those techniques actually fits that definition. The Times announced this in a little memo in the paper slightly over a year ago, in August of 2014, a couple of years ago, August of 2014, signed by the editor, Dean Baquette. They simply announced one day that the editorial board had decided that, or at the urging of their reporters, that that was the terminology they were going to use from then on to refer to those techniques. And so they have. In Times world, or TNOR world, that's the narrative. And of course, we've seen in recent weeks that our new president, on occasion, has invited us to join him in a narrative, a fantasy world of crowd counts and voter fraud that recalls the old joke among psychiatrists, what's the difference between a neurotic and a psychotic? A neurotic builds castles in the air, a psychotic lives in them. They both, by the way, pay rent to psychiatrists. In the various and increasingly frequent ways that this tendency has been showing itself, I think we're in danger of ceasing to be a Western country and starting to become a Middle Eastern one, one that's ruled by narratives rather than by objective reality. And after the march the day following the inauguration of Donald Trump, I expect at some point to start hearing references to the American street, as we occasionally hear references to the Arab street. That's part of the answer of how we got here. Another part of the answer, I think, lies in the political history that followed World War II. Others have written about that history and some earlier relevant history, notably John Fonte and Yoram Hazony, who are the authors, respectively, of a splendid book called Sovereignty or Submission and a splendid essay called Nationalism and the Future of Western Freedom. Daniel Hannan, the British Conservative member of the EU Parliament, may also be counted among that number. All three of these people and others who hold similar views are defenders of the sovereignty of democratic nations as the key to maintaining freedom. All of them describe the current manifestation of an age-old struggle between global governance and self-government. Self-government by nations that adhere to minimal standards of freedom and dignity, standards easily captured, for example, in the Ten Commandments. That kind of government in different nations necessarily involves a variety of constitutions, religions or lack of them, and economies, each serving a population with a more or less shared background and experience. The resulting systems and the ideas that are exchanged and that compete among and within those various nations are bound to result in a variety of governance choices in different countries. So Italy, Greece, Poland, India, Ethiopia, England, Estonia, Finland, Israel, all differ within generally accepted standards of democratic systems. There's no single standard of what system is right, nor is there any aspiration to such a standard. But once universal standards start to begin to prevail, as they did with the experimental unification of the European continent, an experiment that is to say, at the least, showing some strains, then we've come a long way toward accepting a single standard of what's right. And a single standard of what's right is not going to tolerate deviation. Just to offer a few examples from our own politics, President Obama announced in a speech before the General Assembly of the United Nations that the future will not belong to those who defame the Prophet of Islam. The losing candidate for the presidency of the United States told an audience that she was prepared to enlist and to enlist others and the government in a campaign to, quote, protect the rights of what she described as all people to worship the way they choose. By using what she described as, quote, some old-fashioned techniques of peer pressure and shaming, so as to assure that, as she put it, people don't feel they have to support the support to do what we abhor. I say what she described as the right of all people to worship the way they choose, advisedly. That speech was not about the right to worship. That speech was delivered to an entity called the OIC, the Organization for Islamic Cooperation, which is the bloc of 56 Muslim countries at the United Nations plus the Palestinian territories, places where there is only one religion, whose adherents may worship the way they choose, and where if adherents to other religions try to worship the way they choose, they may find themselves under some really concrete pressure. What she had in mind was an intimidation campaign in which the government, in violation of the First Amendment, would participate directly with others in harassment and browbeating directed against people who advocate views about Islam and Islamists that the participants in that campaign abhor. This was part of that candidate's effort to implement UN Human Rights Council Resolution 16/18, which calls upon member states to punish, quote, any advocacy of religious hatred against individuals that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence, unquote. Understand that incitement to violence is not protected under US law, but the important point here is that the test of incitement is less in the United States is less a matter of the content of speech than the consequences of the speech. And in fact, the UN Special Rapporteur on this subject has listed the United States as a country that needs to adopt legislative measures, I should say, to restrict hate speech. In 2010, when the Arizona legislature passed a law that permitted that state's law enforcement agencies and officers to try to enforce laws against illegal immigration, the Obama administration responded with a report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council, a report that aligned the administration with the international effort to brand the state of Arizona as a violator of human rights. By the way, the UN Human Rights Council included such defenders of human rights as Cuba, China, the Russian Federation, and Saudi Arabia. Resort to the United Nations when our own constitutional system is found wanting was not uncommon in the Obama administration. The president supported the idea of submitting to the Security Council a resolution that would call upon states that signed the nuclear test ban treaty, whether they ratified it or not, to refrain from taking any step that would defeat the object and purpose of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. That treaty, although signed by President Clinton, has been rejected by the Senate because it would inhibit this country's ability to modernize its nuclear arsenal. However, if the resolution passes in the UN, international law would appear to prohibit any act that would defeat the object and purpose of the treaty, with the result that U.S. nuclear tests would violate the object and purpose of a treaty that the Senate has refused to ratify. Understand that what's going on here is a substitution of the goal of preordained outcomes in place of the goal of lawful and fair process, and that the method to impose preordained outcomes is old-fashioned intimidation. Although we're most familiar with this phenomenon in the United States because we experience it most directly here, it's by no means confined to this country. Look at the protests from self-designated right thinkers around the world who branded as racists a majority of the voters in the UK who thought their country would be better off if it withdrew from the European Union. The supporters of Brexit, 52% of those who voted on the subject, millions of people, could not be regarded as simply holding a different view of who should run their economy and other aspects of their life in the UK, but rather were to be regarded as morally deficient, because the EU is regarded among opinion shapers as a positive political development, even though the populations of France, the Netherlands, and Ireland, three of the nations that actually comprise the EU, rejected the EU constitution when they had the chance to vote on it. The bureaucrats simply went ahead anyway, disregarding the results of the referendums, so that approval by referendum permitting a common currency and, quote, ever closer union, unquote, was taken as approval of everything that followed. In France, there's a growing body of speech laws. A TV commentator and journalist named Eric Zemmour escaped punishment for commenting that, quote, Chechens, Roma, Kosovars, Africans, and North Africans are today's equivalent of Normans, Huns, Arabs, and the great invasions that followed the fall of Rome, in their tendency to mug, rob, and rape, as he put it. But the radio station on which he made those comments received a warning from France's media authority, the Conseil Supérieur de l'Audiovisuel, and over the summer, he was fined for making similar comments in Belgium. The truth is that in some places in the Western world, people now feel the need to hesitate before acting and speaking, as they would if the norms that gave rise to variations on the theme of freedom and democracy were still in control. There have been several attempts to fight this tendency, some elsewhere, some in our own country. In the UK, for example, the Brexit vote was part of such an attempt. In France, the rise of the Nationalist Party of Marine Le Pen is part of it. In our own country, there are at least two distinct sources of pushback against this tendency. One is religiously inspired and opposes, for example, the Supreme Court's new nationwide definition of marriage or the availability of partial birth abortion, although this point of view rarely takes note of the threat posed by the weakening concept of sovereignty of the national state. The other source of pushback is strongly nationalist, and objects to multilateralism and subjecting ourselves to the control of international organizations and forums. But here, the nationalist pullback rarely takes note of threats to cultural and religious standards. In the United States, we're lucky because we have been given something that nobody else has, to help us resist across the board the forces that would undermine our civic life. On the one hand, the force that pulls us in the direction of accepting standards imposed on us that we haven't adopted for ourselves, and on the other hand, the force that would allow us to resist those standards only in part, either solely the part that offends culture and religion, or solely the part that offends nationalism. There's something that we have, that we've been given, to help keep us out of that quandary and to help us resist across the board the faceless mandarins who run the international bureaucracy and some domestic campuses, as well as the vulgarians who seem increasingly prominent both in and out of public life, is something that other nations do not have. And that something is a written constitution going back 225 years that's still considered a proper object of veneration in our own country, and at least admiration, if not actual veneration elsewhere. It's the oldest, and at a little over 4,000 words, the shortest constitutive document in what we may still call the civilized world. It sets up a government that spreads and balances power between and among three branches of the federal government, as well as between the federal government and the states, a government exquisitely designed to overcome the dilemma described in Federalist 51, that if men were angels, no government would be necessary, and if angels were to govern men, no restraint on government would be necessary. In protecting that written constitution, we can still employ the tools of rhetoric, including ridicule, to hoot down attempts to change that written constitution in the guise of making it, quote, live, unquote, and also to hoot down attempts to claim that because the outcome of the election didn't live up to the expectations of some, or down to the expectations of the remainder, people may retreat into a state of denial and invite others to join them. We can do that only with the sheer tenacity of a sort that involves holding to and insisting on standards of free speech that others may at times mock. The kind of tenacity that I'm referring to was expressed in the inscription on a small brass plate that was fastened to the topmost spar supporting the highest sail on each British man of war back in the days of sailing ships. A short but forceful message to the sailors who had to climb up to that height to fix the sail. That inscription was simple and direct. The inscription was, "Hold fast." Thank you very much, and now I'll be happy to take your questions. The only thing I would ask is that if you're going to ask a question, please make it a question rather than, yes.
I was born under Herbert Hoover. I have a degree from the University of Chicago in 1950 when it was like St. John's. I've been in the international law business. I've been around here for a long time. I'm glad to hear your voice here. I lived through in my adult years between 1949 and 1989, 40 years of witnessing an intense conflict between the United States and its allies and the ideology of Marxism-Leninism. And that intellectual contest, as well as the street-level contest, was at a very high level, and it required a great deal of distinguished thought. And we know the end, and the idea of the liberal democracies, Western civilization, triumphed. Now we are confronted with another great contest, which this time shields itself under something called religion, which we all respect. And what I don't understand, and perhaps you can help me think through this, is why is there an utter absence of secular logic and an arsenal of thought involving anthropologists, psychoanalysts, people who point out that we're dealing with religious psychopaths, dangerous people, menacing people, but they are religious people. And I simply don't know how to think about that. You were the former, senior legal officer for law enforcement and counterterrorism. Perhaps you could help me.
Well, thank you for your question. I always hate questions that begin with, "I want you to help me think," because they usually come from people who are enormously thoughtful and who have obviously thought it through a great deal, as this one did this time. The only thing I can say is that I think we have to summon some of the same thing that you saw between 1949 and 1989 in fighting that aspect of that religious belief that allows those people to go out and advocate killing the rest of us. We don't have to go against the entire religion. We don't have to tell them how to worship on Fridays or Saturdays or Sundays, or whether to cover their heads or not cover their heads. But when their theory includes the same kinds of things, worse things, than communist theory included, then we ought to be able to crack down on it, to oppose it, and to oppose it in the same way that we opposed the doctrines of communism. And there was case law allowing us to do that, and there should be case law, and there will be case law, I believe, that allows us to do the same thing when we start to pull up our socks and do it.
Permit me a brief second level. In one case, we're dealing with rational chess-playing atheists, and in the other case, we're not.
Correct. But we can still use whatever force we have to use. We're dealing with irrational people. But we ought still to be able to argue down their ideology to the extent that it calls for what it appears to call for without incurring or inviting the hatred of people who claim that we're attacking a religion. We're not attacking a religion, we're attacking a political doctrine, a totalitarian political doctrine, not the same doctrine as communism, but one that is just as totalitarian as communism. And I think we ought to be able successfully to do that. We have the intellectual tools to do it. We've been through it once. There's no reason we can't do it a second time. But thank you for the question. Yes. Right.
Could you maybe say a little bit more about that?
Sure. There are supposed to be norms that we all share, things that we all do and don't do. We don't, for example, as one political candidate did, call each other names. We don't make fun of each other's physical characteristics. And once that starts to break down, a society starts to fall apart. I was speaking out in favor of what the President of the University of Chicago did. What the faculty did is to try to take what they regard as the unenforceable and make it enforceable, and that's what I'm against. Yes. I'm sorry, which?
Obergefell, Hodges case.
Obergefell, right.
Yeah. It's one of the series of many cases in the past few decades where, in lieu of ruling based on the text of the Constitution, we've seen justices vote on the basis of political expediency and what's politically popular. In this most recent election, both candidates pushed as primary issues the specific ways their Supreme Court nominees would vote on issues, as though the Supreme Court is some kind of political arena, not an institution of our judicial system that rules on the Constitution as a document. So my question is this an inherent problem with the Supreme Court? And we've come so far that judicial activism is sort of inevitable. Is there any hope that, you know, we can turn things back?
Yeah, it's been going on thank you for the question. I think it's an excellent question. I think they were both equally wrong. This has been going on for a long time. Different people mark the beginning of it at different times. I'm trying to think of the name of the case in Connecticut. A case involving sale of birth control medications in Connecticut. Griswold, thank you very much. In Griswold versus Connecticut, a group of Yale law students and their professors brought a lawsuit against the state of Connecticut to strike down as unconstitutional the Connecticut statute that banned the sale of such devices and medications. In fact, that statute was never enforced, and they had to contrive a set of facts in which some professor stepped forward and you know, volunteered to sell it, or some drug pharmacist stepped forward and volleunteered to sell the stuff and was fined $100, and the case went on up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court took it. When that kind of thing, I mean, when courts become a substitute for the political arena in settling disputes and invite political disputes to be brought to court, then it matters who the judges are. If judges are simply deciding cases based on an objectively verifiable constitution, where words actually, you know, mean what they say, then what you, require is legal talent. When you're deciding cases based on a, quote, living, unquote, constitution, i.e. a constitution that is to be shaped according to the will and whim of whoever's in power, then it very much matters. And then the fight gets very intense about who should and shouldn't be on the Supreme Court. There was a time when it was considered rude to ask a Supreme Court nominee substantive questions about their views of the law. The people were asked things about their background and training, and that was pretty much it. All that stopped after Griswold, and politicians have been complicit in it, in being happy to yield up political questions to a court and then say, not my problem, right? I don't have to be the legislator who votes for or against a bill to restrict abortion or not to restrict abortion. I can say, but you know, it's the court's problem. And of course, judges, and that business doesn't attract shrinking violets, I can tell you. Judges are all too happy to say, hey, bring us your controversies. We will solve them. Yes.
Hi, first of all, I want to say thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
I'm a freshman.
Me too. This is my first day here.
Robert Maynard Hutchins, the founder of the Rachel's program, he said that an educated person is one who can understand what he reads and articulate his every thought. And that's one of the reasons that I came here. I'm a Muslim American. I'm also one of the only Muslim students at this college. I'm not here to exert my safe space or anything. I came here to talk about ideas and pursue the truth, whatever that is. I firmly believe that on a philosophical level, on a deeply philosophical level, the East and West, you know, Judeo, Christianity, and Islam, they are not incompatible of the other. In fact, they're mutually commensurable in a deep way. However, in a world where often the only voices that are heard are the extreme voices of radicals or terrorists or the extremes on each side, then I often feel like my voice isn't heard. So my question is, how does a person like me, you know, express myself in a world where people only listen to the most radical of the radical?
There are others like you. And I would hope that the world would listen more to them, number one. Number two, I would hope that administrations would be more responsible about who they listen to and whom they empower in the Muslim community. So, for example, there's a man named Dr. Zudi Jasser who heads an organization that I don't know in detail what your beliefs are. I think he would be very harmonious with him. He's a splendid human being, a former lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy, who has spoken out against extremism, who finds himself attacked at every turn, and yet he has never been invited to the White House. By contrast, an organization like CARE their people are invited to the White House. Now, what is some ordinary middle-class person supposed to think, who is Muslim, supposed to think when the government goes around empowering people who grab the microphone and speak for the extreme and reject people who speak for the point of view that you speak for? That's a reprehensible thing. And I think that I mean, I'm first of all, I admire you. And secondly, I would hope that you and others like-minded would band together and get the recognition from the, I mean, hopefully get the recognition from among others, from the government that you deserve, and then from the rest of society that you deserve. So, bravo. And bravo to you for being here. This is a great school. Yes?
This is a big question, and of course you may answer it however you please. What do you think
of the
administration?
If I say I try not to, I... Look, I know several people in the new administration, and there's a lot I don't know about it, including about the person who heads it, who is a big mystery to me, as he may very well be to many people in this room. My view is I try to do what I can to make things better in the little area that I know something about, which is the Department of Justice. And so, you know, I try to work to get rational people in charge there and to get rational policies adopted by the government. That's all I can do. I don't know very much about the rest. I do know that many of the cabinet nominees seem to be people of substance who have testified, by the way, that they disagree with some of the more spectacular pronouncements of the person who headed the ticket. So, I mean, that's to a certain extent hopeful. How that plays out, I have no idea. But I want to also reassure you, based on my own experience down there, that there is a limit to what any one person can do, even if he happens to be the President of the United States. You can't do damage, serious damage, yourself, even as President. It takes other people around you who agree with and are willing to carry out the particular fascination that you hold at any given moment, and with him they vary from moment to moment, right? And he doesn't appear to be surrounded by such people. So there's a lot to be hopeful about. But that said, the tone is set, obviously, at the top, and that isn't always the sort of tone that you'd want to see and hear. Yes. First, gentleman closer to me, and then the gentleman behind you. You, yeah. Refusing to do it is a start. We have a military that is very well schooled in the laws of war, and which doesn't hesitate to make it clear what their view is of doing things that violate international law. Look at the reaction of the military to his having said that he wanted us to bomb the families of terrorists. The reaction was, we ain't doing it. And they wouldn't. There is no member of the chain of command who would ever carry out a direction of the kind that you just described. I mean, I don't think it's going to develop that way. I don't think we will be in danger of anything like that.
Actually, maybe you can educate us. Is there actually a process that I'm going to press this button, or does it take for the people to?
He doesn't simply press a button. There are codes that, which, when engaged, indicate that an order is coming from the president. There are still people who have to carry it out. I mean, he doesn't have his finger on a button that's connected to a doomsday machine that launches rockets. Pardon?
People have to carry it out.
Yes, human beings, all of whom have gone through either West Point or Annapolis or the Air Force Academy. Which is to say, all of whom are trained in obedience to the law, and all of whom wouldn't do it.
You don't think they would?
know very well that they wouldn't. Yes. I mean, sometimes personnel is policy. Yes.
I had a question in mind earlier, but I think I would rather ask one that came up because of what you were saying about the Supreme Court and constitutional adjudication. I am a lawyer, I've been a lawyer since 1973, and I spent 12 years on the bench. When I was very young, I believed strongly that an objective, text-driven, history-driven interpretation of the Constitution was the right thing to do, and that it was possible. Over the years, I've become increasingly convinced that it is much more difficult than I ever imagined that it would be, and that it may not even be possible, and that it may not even always be desirable, because if the court takes a position that is strongly adverse to the mores of the community for which it is responsible for making laws, it may end up doing harm to the system as well as to a lot of people. And I wonder if you can comment on that idea.
It's an abstract set of ideas, and it's hard for me to think of a situation in which the court, following the text and the history of the Constitution, could come out making a decision that is adverse to the interests of, seriously adverse to the interests of the population of this country. I just don't see it. I hate to argue with the question, but I have no choice. I agree with you that it's hard. Decisions of the kind that you described are aspirational. Judges try to do it. Sometimes they succeed, sometimes they don't. But they ought to be trying to do that rather than hallucinate what the word due process means. I mean, when I hear a term like substantive due process, I react the same way that I react when I hear vegetarian hamburger. I don't know exactly what it is, but I know damn well that it's got nothing to do with a hamburger. Yes.
So I'm wondering about, you described an environment on college campuses, and I'm wondering about what parallels, if any, you would draw to the Red Scare of the 1950s, how those two environments are similar or how they're different, and then if they are, insofar as they're similar, what lessons can we draw from the Red Scare to understand what you're seeing on college campuses?
I don't think they're similar. The Red Scare was fear of the other. This is fear of ideas, that was, you know, was fear of particular people, and this is, you know, refusal to let people say things, or refusal to hear things, or insistence that you know that up is down and black is white and so on. When the opposite is true, I don't think they're similar. Yes.
So at St. John's, we have the discussion-based classes, seminar and tutorial, and people talk with each other back and forth, reason with each other, and usually we don't end up with a consensus in the end of class. But we also don't vote in the end of class to say what is right. But in the political world, right, it seems that people use voting to decide what is right or what is wrong. And if some objective truth there, how does voting or this democratic process help people to acquire truth?
I think we rarely vote on what's right and what's wrong. I think we vote on who will occupy particular offices. They may advocate ideas, they may advocate programs, social programs or plans for the society at large. I think we rarely vote on what's right and wrong. We usually don't decide issues in this country by referendum. There are states where they do that. I think it's a bad idea. Usually we simply elect people, hope that they carry out policies we agree with, and if they don't, then they get voted out the next election, precisely for the reasons that you were referring to. Voting on right and wrong is a divisive and not a very productive exercise. I think people say that what they're pursuing is true, but those are people with a political interest, and I think voters are smart enough to figure out that candidates are running on a complex based on a complex set of issues that usually have very little to do with right and wrong, have a great deal to do with allocation of resources and things of that kind. Yes?
I had a question regarding very close to the beginning of your speech. The concrete effects of the political, you mentioned that a confusion in the abstract having concrete effects. I was wondering, with that in mind, what do you view the status of law? Is it an abstract? Is it in somehow more concrete than this political that was brought up? And I guess with your answer, there might be a problem.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but let me respond this way. When the person who made that statement, there were the 150 faculty members who made that statement, the concrete pressures of the political, what they were talking about is the pressures that people feel from the desired political outcome, and those being substantial enough to silence a speaker, to be an excuse to silence a speaker. Law isn't anything like that. We don't silence people in the name of the law.
I guess I wasn't speaking to that point. You mentioned that this political was an abstract. So keeping in mind an abstract force or an abstract concept having a concrete effect, just in that complete generality, what is the status of law, its ontological status?
Law obviously has concrete results. If you cross against the light, you get a ticket. If you pass a red light, you get a ticket. If you shoot somebody, you go to jail. What's the question behind the question?
Might be a little Johnny.
I have a related question that may help to make it more concrete.
Okay.
So the fact that you mentioned objective facts implies that law also has to deal with subjective values. And one thing that is happening right now is that people who claim to be in a position of victimization can point to an objective history of certain minority groups not having equal rights with the majority. And in your example of someone killing someone else, and the question has to be not just of the act, but of the intent, and someone can be charged with murder or with manslaughter, something like, for example, Title IX, where the campus laws about sexual harassment and such.
Mm-hmm.
Someone can be accused of sexually harassing someone else, and then they go through a process to determine whether or not it's true. But until
the process is often... Well, I mean, you want to get into a discussion of Title IX, I suppose I'm happy to do that.
It wasn't really... Okay. Because in that case, regardless of whether or not the person is found guilty of sexually harassing, if, for example, more than one claim is placed, then the person has to leave campus. This is just a concrete example. So this person is adversely affected.
What do I think of that? I think it's outrageous. We don't use the law to salve people's feelings. We use the law to decide whether an objective, I mean, among other things, to decide whether an objective condition that society can't put up with exists or doesn't. And if we can't prove it, then somebody's just going to have to put up with their subjective feelings. Because the price that you have to pay for, as you described it, in my view, is a lot too high. Are objectively affected?
In the sense that if I feel that, I don't know, as a Cuban, I am offended by the fact that you refer to Cuba as a totalitarian regime, which I'm not, I agree with you.
Okay. It's okay.
But if I feel like my position as a Cuban socioeconomically is participating in this historical trend of not being a louder voice, because for example, my father is a computer engineer, and he was not allowed to work for the NSA when he applied to work there in the late 70s, early 80s. And that's understandable because it was especially then considered enemy state. But given the fact that there are examples like that where a person's belonging to a certain group or a certain conflict of ideologies can lead to those kinds of objective consequences of being prevented from having a socioeconomic opportunity, how would you say...
remedy that by rules that end that practice. You don't remedy it by putting somebody in jail or throwing somebody off campus. Yes?
I think tying these questions together, my question is, is there a part of America's political character, political philosophy that informed America, say, like Locke's letter concerning toleration, that's built into our regime, and we are tolerant, but we're intolerant of intolerance. And so how do we rectify that with a force, an unstoppable force, say a religious force, without a popular enlightenment? I think that kind of ties in the questions.
I don't know whether you've just asked a question or whether you've just tied the questions together and for the purpose of explaining them.
I guess what I'm wondering in your speech is that it seems to suggest law is a solution to intolerance, but I think that the people that are intolerant are actually under the guise of tolerance. That's what's going on in universities.
Right.
So is that something part of the American political character?
I'm not sure I'm equipped to answer that. Yes?
Could you expound on the legal versus the political or other factors that went into the decision on the case of Citizens United and whether there is any possibility of reversing that?
Citizens United simply had to do with whether a corporation can make a political donation. The question is whether the law permitted that or not. Could people use a corporation to exercise free speech? And the answer to that is they could, just the same way that they can use a labor union to exercise free speech, or any other agglomeration of people to exercise free speech. You say, can it be reversed? Is it physically possible? Sure. Do I think it's necessary? No. I think it's Citizens United is a great bugaboo. Labor unions make political contributions. Some corporations make political contributions. People make political contributions of all kinds for all reasons. So that doesn't necessarily mean that what they contribute to prevails. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
It doesn't involve the dark money and the effects that people have immense wealth. And
dark money is an epithet that people use generally for the money that's put up by people they disagree with. I mean, there are certain people who are not allowed to make political contributions. You can't, as a foreigner, you can't make a political contribution in the United States. But if that's what you mean by dark money, I don't think that happens.
Do you think there should be some limits on the use of immense wealth for inordinate
inordinate.
I mean, that one individual who happens to have immense wealth should be able to...
You mean like George Soros?
Soros, the Koch brothers.
The Koch brothers? Yeah. Let them spend. It's good for the economy. Yes.
I think I can say safely and reasonably that it's the case that our founding fathers had a great deal of intent. I think you'd agree when they wrote the Constitution, and as well that they used a number of moral guiding principles in doing so. It's also the case that it specified that the powers not enumerated for the federal government are reserved for the states. It seems like that's a theme throughout some of your speech tonight, that it might be problematic that, say, for example, judicial bodies seem to take over that position for the states. I'm wondering how it is that, given our founding fathers' morality when writing our first body of law, how do we see historical events that required the intervention of the federal government? I'm thinking, say, the civil rights movement, the integration of schools. If those things hadn't happened, it seems to me that there would have been a greater number of American people dead. That I should like very much to believe that state governments are capable of legislating in a moral way, but it doesn't seem like they always agree.
So far, you referred to one phenomenon, the civil rights movement.
Sure.
You've referred to it in two different ways, but it's the same thing. It is also the historical problem that was built in at the time our Constitution was written, and that we had to try to grapple with, and grappled with unsuccessfully, but at least tried to grapple with in a civil war. Anything other than that?
I suppose the more general question, given that it doesn't seem as though the Civil War has adequately solved the problem, I think
it came pretty close.
in a good deal of ways, yes. I wonder how it is that you want states to legislate morally or to reserve that power to the states. It doesn't seem as though the federal government has any guiding principles within the Constitution but relies solely on the individuals of which its government is comprised. It doesn't always seem like that works out best for the people. I think it would be hard to regard those as simply the casualties of a political deliberative process. People who are dying regularly nowadays, because it doesn't seem as though...
Who's dying regularly?
American citizens.
Of
citizens of America.
I know, but what are they dying of?
I would say police violence is a grand epidemic in this country.
Really? I would say that citizen on citizen violence is an even bigger epidemic.
I don't think that one invalidates the other.
Correct. But one is a lot rarer than the other. Anybody else? Yes.
Do you think our government responds to the will of the people or to lobbies?
Little of each.
How could we manage expert opinions in the field in a better way?
Managing expert opinions is principally the job of Congress, and they hold hearings and listen to experts. A lot of that work gets done by congressional staffs. I think that government in the large, in terms of setting large policies, is not a matter of experts, and it's a matter that it's a matter for the citizenry at large. And I think we all hopefully get interested in that and see that on a daily basis. Yes?
So I've been thinking about this all day, and I know you kind of addressed some of this over the last couple, all the questions, but when you talked about taking the unenforceable and making it enforceable and being against that.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And then,
I don't think I was very clear about this.
Causes society to break down, but I think the problem. But then, I'm not articulating this great, but.
But that control, but that controlling it is worse. And my prescription for that is, we all ought to get a little bit of self-restraint. That's hard to come by. But that's one of the things that made me nervous about the last campaign, and that is that a lot of the rules came down on a lot of things that people wouldn't do or say got done and said. And I think that once that starts to happen, we ought to start to be concerned. But you can't start to be concerned by shutting people up. You start to be concerned by controlling yourself and urging that other people control themselves.
I wonder what the appropriate way to respond, though, to say, like, an alt-right individual who's like speaking at a university campus and using hate speech openly. How do you, like, is it
argue him down? It's appropriate to protest it. I think it's not appropriate to shout him down.
Yeah.
I mean, assuming you're going to invite him in the first place. Yeah. You invite him, he speaks, and you can ask him hostile questions afterwards. Carry signs outside if you're inclined to do that. But shouting somebody down, I think, feeds their sense of persecution and doesn't necessarily advance your own cause very much.